the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast featuring the Crop Doctors.
Good morning from the Crop Doctors Podcast studio in Stoneville. Tom and I got two special guests with us this morning. Weed scientist Frank Carey. Frank works for Valent USA. Frank's been on with us in the past several years ago. I don't even have any idea what we would have talked about on that.
I think we were talking burn down, actually.
I know Bobby was still here, so that puts a little date on that. That's been at least 4 or 5 years ago. And then Tom Eubank. Tom's been on with us more recently talking about horse weeds. Tom's local. Frank's not. Frank traveled down from Olive Branch this morning to visit with us. So thank y'all for coming.
Glad to be here.
Tom, I won't tell him you made a circle getting here.
Yeah. Kind of forgot.
The pollen got to you. It's the pretty weather. It's the sunshine. Something else. I get it.
Frosty. This is the frosty morning.
Yes, it was frosty this morning.
Tom, you think that's going to be the last frost?
I'm not going to go out on that limb. I'd already gone out on that limb, and I was wrong.
Y'all going to weigh in?
I'm going no. It's not Easter yet.
Okay. Easter's early.
Easter's early.
Very early. It's in 12 days.
Tom,
our nutrient weather guru says that we may be in for another cold round the latter part of March. So he's saying we may not be done just yet.
I don't know that I've said this in here, so I don't know if it's recorded or not. However, it thundered on January the 27th. You know what that means, Tom Allen?
I do not, although I'm sure we've discussed that, but you're going to tell me again.
The old wives' tale is if it thunders in January, it's going to frost on that same day of the month in April.
Huh. If you said that, I had forgotten. So you do a really good job.
The prediction from Jason Bond, April 27th.
No. I'm just telling you what the old wives' tale says. No, don't put that.
Is that in the Farmer's Almanac?
Probably.
Okay.
Don't put that on me, man. I'll make it to my house. Oh,
his phone may ring now.
Ooh, yeah. We invited Tom and Frank this morning. Frank and I were having a conversation in Starkville a couple weeks ago that got a little deep on some weed topics. And so I said, man, you just need to come to Stoneville and we'll record a podcast on it. So that's how this thing kind of came about. We don't know exactly which direction that we're going to go. Tom Allen is going to take the reins on trying to guide the conversation. But Tom and Frank, I'm going to ask my question to both of y'all. I'm going to give you both an opportunity to answer it. And then Tom Allen, this may give you some insight in where to guide the conversation. So both of y'all been weed scientists for a long time. Both of y'all were working professionally prior to Roundup Ready.
Yes.
You also both have sons that are at some level engaged in weed science currently.
Yes.
So my question is, if you were talking, in your case, Frank, to Drew, or in Tom's case, to Will, what weed would y'all tell them that they want nothing to do with? They don't have to deal with it now because we're into our whatever third decade, almost our fourth decade of Roundup Ready. But what weed from the past would your son not want to deal with?
Wow. Okay.
Cue the Jeopardy theme, Tom.
Do, 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 do. I'm going to go with sickle pod.
Oh, man. I was going to go with sickle pod.
Solid choice.
Well, right. You have to pick something else now, Frank.
All right. Got
to
pick something else. I'm going to go with pitted morning glory.
Okay. Pitted's around. Probably not our worst morning glory right now.
I just remember trying to walk through cotton fields way back when.
Oh, yeah.
And then having to break out the lay-by rigs and going with the Cobra Blade X, trying to burn the morning glories out so we could get in there and work around the cotton.
All right, so Tom, why sickle pod?
Well, prior to Roundup tolerant crops, it was nearly impossible to kill unless you...
It was.
You basically had one or two options, and if you didn't get out really, really early and apply it when it was really small, you missed it completely. And I've seen it bad enough to where it would completely inundate a field, and high seed production and anything that makes a classic problematic weed is reproduces oftentimes, you know, many times throughout the year and produces a lot of seed each one of those events. So it was a bad one back in the day.
My two cents is going to be cocklebur. I know we were talking about cocklebur before we started, but mine's going to be cocklebur. Reason being, when we were chopping cocklebur out of the cotton field, you had to chop a cucklebur once they got big. You know, you had to hit that thing at least twice with a hoe. Tom, you had to swing the hoe down and kind of whack the top out of it so you could see where the base was and then cut it off at the ground. So it was at least a two-swipe chopping on a cucklebur. So that's mine.
I'm sure I shouldn't even ask this question, but which one of those three has the potential to make a comeback?
Oh, a sickle pod, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
Why?
Because I don't know that we have anything now that would kill it. I mean, with the morning glories, first rate, which we use quite a bit of still for different things. First rate is an excellent morning glory herbicide that was not around pre-Roundup Ready. They kind of came about the same time, first rate and Roundup Ready. But sickle pod, man, I don't know. Like if you call me and tell me you have sickle pod and conventional soybeans, I'm not sure I'd know off the top of my head what to tell you to put on it. It's a bad day, Tom. I'm being serious. It's a really tough weed to control.
Yeah, you're back to chlorimuron on cotyledon, one leaf.
Yep.
I mean, think about the tea weed. Like you can kill a one-inch tea weed, prickly cider, but you can't kill a 2 or 3-inch prickly cider. Sickle pod goes in that same category with sensitivity to timing.
Well, and then we'll start with that weed because I jotted down a few things on this list to try to keep my mind squared away on what direction we should go on this. But let's talk about the prickly cider situation because all of us in this room could say we've seen an increase in that particular weed in the last few years. Why has there been an increase in that particular weed of recent time?
Well, I'll let Tom or Frank answer that. I mean, what's y'all's ideas on it? Why so bad so fast? Frank, gears are grinding over there.
Yeah, gears are grinding. I mean, prickly cider has always been there. We've never beat it back to where it wasn't something we were fighting.
But it never was
priority. It never was priority. It was one of those that was always out there, and it was always out there in numbers. If you had a glyphosate going out there, you put a little something with it, it would go ahead and knock it out, or at least knock it back far enough where you didn't see it, and it wasn't something that you had to mentally deal with. And I think that what we've seen recently, and I may be wrong on this, but we've seen enough change in our weed control strategies and what growers are doing that with the addition of products like dicamba or the 2,4-D that are not as good on prickly cider, and you're seeing a heavy reliance on those, you're just not doing the job. We're seeing a shift in the practices out there, and that's causing that particular weed to really flourish.
I'll go way back. It all ultimately boils down to selection pressure. You know, the products that we're using are not as effective on a particular weed, and that's why we see weed manifest and blow up, as we say, in a short period of time. And I'll go all the way back to the Treflan days. When Treflan was first launched, you know, one of the primary weed issues that cotton growers faced was grasses. They had a hard time managing grass in cotton. And when Treflan came out, it was like a godsend because they managed the grass impeccably in that crop, and growers were extremely satisfied with it, and that's all they were doing was Treflan because that was one of the only herbicides that they had at that time. But I distinctly remember I had a lot of friends that were with Dow back in the day when they launched Treflan, and they started getting calls from growers that tea weed was just blowing up in these fields following these applications of Treflan, and it was so bad that there was actually a rumor going around that there was tea weed in jugs of Treflan, that it had to be in the jug of Treflan because you put the Treflan out and they never had tea weed before, and then all of a sudden there's tea weed all over the field. Well, we know that's not the case, and it's there again, it goes to selection. And so tea weed was a very problematic weed even after the launch of Treflan. It removed a lot of troublesome species, but it just selected for another weed to take its place. And there again, we're never going to be rid of weeds. And unless you mix up your weed control tactics with different modes of action, different strategies, different cropping systems, you're going to have these weed issues continue to manifest themselves.
Tom, I want to come back to that, but I'll pose this as a question related to the prickly cider. If we go and spray Roundup in a plot on prickly cider and just say it's a little big. So in the case of prickly cider, it's 2 to 3 inches. You got the weed guide right there, Frank. It's probably rated like an 8, maybe.
Maybe.
8 gets you bold print. It may not even have bold print. It's maybe glyphosate is just a 7 on prickly cider. So in the years leading up to Xtend, so 2015, 16, that time frame, what were we mixing with glyphosate that was further taking out the prickly cider? Because it's there. We didn't blow up the numbers that quick when we started spraying Roundup and dicamba. So we'll speculate on what we were using that came out of the system when we commercialized Xtend that was combining with the Roundup to take that number down to where it was not a priority weed for us.
There's a lot of the ALS chemistry going in with the tanks of Roundup, whether it was my memory on particular trade names, but Classic was always going in there. There's a lot of resource went in there. So we were putting anything that was relatively inexpensive, we were putting in there because it was the prickly cider, it was the morning glory. There were several species there that were driving that need to put something else in there with the glyphosate. But I hung up on what Tom's Eubank said just a minute ago on the tref land and controlling grasses. Do you think that the prickly cider might just be one of those that doesn't have a strong competitive fit? So if there's something else out there, it just outcompetes it and keeps it under check. And then when you take out all those other competitive species, it's allowed to flourish and it just comes up. And it's not that we didn't control it. It's always been there. But it was just being outcompeted.
Well, you can get into the whole weed seed bank and all the rest of that within the soil profile. And that Tom mentioned like competitiveness and all that. We don't spend enough time talking about those types of things because that's lofty biology.
So Frank, that's exactly what, when I told Tom I wanted to come back to what Tom Eubank said on the prickly side, I hadn't thought about that. I mean, I had always thought about it from the herbicide standpoint, the question I posed to you, which herbicide did we bring out of it? So in biology, that's the safe site concept.
Mm-hmm.
You learn that in weed biology class. That's the whole premise of weed interference with crops, right? You want to make a safe site around that crop plant to minimize the interference that would ultimately reduce the yield. And this is the same kind of thing. It's just competition between two weed species rather than competition between a weed species and a crop species. It's very possible that combination of the growth habit, growth rate, and germination requirements that prickly cider is not very competitive with grass, and that's why you saw it kind of blow up, so to speak, when we removed that grass pressure. You could apply that same concept to what we have seen over the past 6 or 7 years with prickly cider in Xtend crops. All right, same concept. Right before we started, get a phone call from a guy about prostrate knotweed. All right, man, most folks listening probably don't even know what prostrate knotweed is. Classic turn row weed, right? Generally, it'll thrive on low fertility, loves compaction because it grows in a turn row a lot. It's a polygonum species, so it's going to have stuff on the plant, Tom, that's going to look similar to a smartweed. It's very different than a smartweed, but it's in the same family. So I get calls occasionally every year, but not from a lot of guys that have a problem with knotweed. Well, when you call me and I got nothing, I mean, I got no idea. Will Liberty kill it? I don't know. Never sprayed Liberty on a knot. I've never sprayed a knotweed. I've never had knotweed in a plot. If you call me and I got nothing and I can't call somebody, I can't call Larry Steckel and say, hey, man, what kills knotweed? Because Larry's not going to know either. How is that? How has that come to be? Because it's not just knotweed. There are others, and we can talk about those too, whether it be yellowcress or some of these other kind of early spring challenges that we run into.
Yeah, and then mentioned, so are we selecting for that? Because I think that needs to be a part of the answer.
Well,
for that based on the herbicide technology or the traits that we have focused on?
I can't say no. But when I've asked myself the same question, because just looking at data that comes in from research trials, and let's say you're doing a burn down research trial, Valent puts a burn down trial with Jason, and the weeds that you're going to get back are you're going to get some horseweed data, you're going to get some ryegrass data, you may get some henbit data, and that's kind of the big three.
Yep.
And you get past that, you may get a general
winter
broadleaf rating, because Tom Eubank is the only person I know that can actually identify those cool season broadleaves that are out there.
No question. He's the
rest
only
of
one
us are like, send a picture to Tom. He'll tell us what it is.
Yep.
So in that regard, though, is prostrate knotweed a winter annual or a summer annual?
I think it's a summer annual.
It is a summer annual. And so why are we seeing it now as big as it is? Because I've gotten the same calls, and I'm talking about huge clumps of knotweed in March.
Right.
It's not supposed to be there. There again, to your point, Frank, I think we're seeing this adaptiveness of weeds, this selection pressure being put on them, forcing them to adapt to other means. And I'm struggling with what exactly is going on with knotweed. Is it transitioning to a somewhat of a biennial type morphology, to where it's coming up in the late fall and just sitting there kind of dormant, and then going through that bolt stage, kind of like what horseweed does in the spring? That's the only explanation I can logically reason out of my mind, because it's not supposed to come up in January or February and be as big as it is in March as a summer annual.
So are we seeing that every year, or is it just this year that's really popping up?
Last couple of years, I've seen
it. Yeah, it's been a recurring problem in the past, since 2020, and that's just a estimate, but the last few years.
This past year, I mean, we had the ability, it was so warm and dry in the fall, we had the ability to do so much tillage that we stimulated a lot of germination of weeds early, because we had bare soil and not crop stubble or something like that out there. So I just wonder if our ability to do that fall tillage may have contributed to something.
I can't answer that. I don't know if we're giving any answers to anything. Same concept. The ones that have gotten more, I guess, notoriety right around here in the past few years, the yellowcress. And then, to me, a bigger problem, more widespread problem at least, I don't know if it's more difficult problem, is the Virginia pepperweed. So 2020, 21, maybe into 22, got a lot of calls about yellowcress. Kind of North Bolivar County seemed to be the epicenter of that. But then probably in 2022, I wish I had counted the number of different counties that I had gotten questions from about it, because it was several, maybe even into double-digit counties in the Delta. Since then, it's been almost exclusively pepperweed. And so the yellowcress, I can maybe give more of an explanation for, because it wasn't one that you would rate in plots, Frank, with your collective winter annuals. It wasn't there. It's not invasive. It's not non-native to Mississippi, but it was not a widespread problem. So I can kind of explain that it just increased, and we can speculate again on the reasons why it increased. There's different species of it as well. But this pepperweed, we've always had pepperweed, and you can go outside in April and May, and you could see the little tufty seed heads on Virginia pepperweed and know you had pepperweed. Do not know that I had ever seen it growing in a field after a crop was planted until maybe 3 years ago. So, Frank, just one day I'm talking to Tom about pepperweed. Tom Eubank, not Tom Allen. That's not the kind of conversations me and Tom Allen have. So me and Tom are talking about pepperweed, and he makes the observation that the stuff that he sees now is a lot bigger than what we would be accustomed to seeing growing on a turn row or around a well head or something where you would traditionally expect to see it. And he's right. So then I think about the yellowcress, and one of the first years that we had yellowcress, Tom, a guy sent you pictures, and he sent me the same pictures, and me and Tom identified it differently. I think we were both right. No, he sent us different pictures, but it turned out it was all yellowcress. I don't remember the exact story, but it ended up being the two different species of yellowcress, and which is, to me, incredibly frustrating. Again, I don't know that we're going to answer this, but how is this all of a sudden a problem? Because the pepperweed always been here, and I always tease guys that I know when they call me, like around this time of year, about pepperweed, like what'll kill pepperweed? And my response is usually Roundup 2 months ago, because I don't have any idea how to kill it once it gets big. And I also have a hard time identifying it before it gets big. So when it's in that rosette stage that a lot of those winter annuals go through as they progress through their life cycle, I mean, they all look alike. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they are. It's just not one of those that you go identify like a hen bit or like a horseweed, like what you said. So there's not even a question in there. I'm just speculating now.
Talk about the geography of that. Start with your knotweed. So you are both, Tom and Jason, are both getting questions about this knotweed. Is it geographically centered within a specific area? Is there a range within the Delta that you're only running across this knotweed?
I think it's only the Delta right now that I'm
seeing
or hearing of this.
And but the area I get calls from would be a decently small, you know, 1 to 3 counties in the Delta. But that's just the calls that come to me. I mean, Tom's fielding calls from a different group of people than usually what I'm fielding calls from. If you think about the Yellowcrest, Tom, again, that kind of North Bolivar County area is where we first started getting calls from it. But now I get calls really from all over. And I talked to Tom Barber about it in Arkansas. He sees it over there. They seem to have a lot more, it's a similar species, not related, but common groundsel. Can look similar, doesn't have a yellow flower too. Mm-hmm. It's got the same flower color. It's a very different weed. So I feel like Tom and them have more groundsel over there, but he's also seen Yellowcrest pretty widespread too. I struggle to, as why all of a sudden a weed that is native to Mississippi or has long been established in Mississippi, whether or not it's truly native or not, I'm not sure about that. Why it all of a sudden becomes a humongous problem where it's present.
I think one question we have to continue to stress with these situations is, you know, what is the program that they've been utilizing? And if they've been on the same program for more than 2 or 3 years, they need to change it up. And I can't remember, I think it was Alan York said one time when in managing glyphosate-resistant Palmer amaranth back in the day is, if it's working for you good today, you need to change it up next year to try to preserve the chemistries. And, you know, when you talk about a burn-down window, which is most of the, you know, the pepperweed, the groundsel, the yellowcrest, all of these weeds that are beginning to show up, we need to ask the question, what are you using for a burn down? And if they've been on the same program for the last 2 or 3 years, that would probably lead to credence that we're probably selecting for those weeds that we're beginning to see, and we need to swap it up and change it up.
Well, and then I don't mean to throw a wrench into that conversation, but then if you go back to what you talked about on prickly cider, so are you selecting an environment where it more readily germinates and comes out? So you're knocking a weed out of the system to open the door for that one to become a problem.
We're doing a lot of stale seed bed now, right? Doing a lot of tillage in the fall, hipping up in the fall. Most people are using some type of fall residual now to manage ryegrass, horseweed, other weeds. Valor, excellent product in that system. Boundaries, another popular product. But neither one of those is going to have the longevity to control a late winter, early spring emerging weed like the pepper weeds, the cresses, these polygonum species. So maybe changing up the program again a little bit to where putting an ALS chemistry in there, you know, a lot of the work that I did way back when showed that just putting an ALS in there like a chlorimuron or a chlorantrolam methyl really helped to increase the longevity of that residual herbicide on some of these spring emerging weeds. And horseweed obviously was one of the ones that I was most interested in. But I do recall that just putting that little extra component in there really helped to stretch out that residual efficacy.
Tommy, you also showed, and I'm sure you talked about this last year when we were talking about horseweed exclusively, but thinking about it as a winter annual, and you showed that it, around here at least, we had populations that didn't always behave as a winter annual. They could be biennial, meaning they would grow over greater than a 12-month period. And then you had a bunch that came up in the summer months too.
Yep. Ryegrass was seeing the same thing too, right? I mean, typically you see most of it coming up in October, November in the fall of the year, but you can get spring-emerged ryegrass, you can get spring-emerged horseweed. If the conditions are right, you could have emergence any time of year. Depends on the environment. The weeds are there. The seed banks is awash with these weeds. It's just a matter of the conditions are right. I think it all goes back again to overlaying residuals. Foundationally, that's what we used to do when we didn't have over-the-top options, we overlaid residuals. When Roundup came along, you know, we kept using residuals for a little while, and then we slowly got away and just started going Roundup only over the top. Then we went back to using residuals again, right? We started putting out at planting products. We started coming over the top with Prefix, you know, which may have been Frank helping us on the T-weed a little bit. Not a great product for control of T-weed, but it will take out a few, and it will help control a few from a residual standpoint. And then dicamba comes along, and guess what? Take the residuals back out of the mix again. So I'm always going to be a staunch advocate for using residual chemistries, but then also, you know, trying to mix them up, look at those different modes of action. And that would be a great podcast talk one day, you know, is going through the modes of action and just making sure we're not overlapping, because there's so many generics out there today. You may be thinking that you're using a different mode of action when in reality it's the same.
Possibly even the same AI.
Right.
Yeah.
I want to jump in real quick because I agree 100% what Tom said about the lack of residuals and how we have this cycle of using residuals. Then the savior comes along and we ride that wagon until it breaks, and then we're back to where. So we get in these ruts and these cycles. But I wonder also if we're not taking our eye off the ball somewhat. In warm season weeds, we had to focus on all the grasses and the broadleaves, and then Palmer became resistant to everything, and so we focused on Palmer. And all of a sudden, everything we're doing is focusing on Palmer. And when we're doing that, did it not open the door for something else to sneak in on us? And here we are in a burndown scenario. And years ago, we focused on horseweed because it was the first thing that was resistant. And we had all of these strategies to control horseweed, and we got it under control, but it opened the door for something else to germ around. And also now we're focused on ryegrass. And by focusing on ryegrass now, one of the big things we talk about is the fall residual or the fall tillage, keeping it clean. Is that now that we're adopting those practices, opening the door for something else like the pepperweed or the knotweed or something that's sneaking up on us now that we don't have our eye on that, and we're focused on something else?
Yeah, I think that's as good an explanation as any, Frank. In the things related to that, because it's Mother Nature, right? And nothing's in a vacuum. I mean, it's constantly in a state of flux, and it's constantly in a state of response to the environment and the selection pressures that are placed on it, whether that's chemical selection pressure or selection pressure from tillage or environment or whatever. There's years where we see weeds because the response to the environment. You know, you get a real wet spring, you're going to see nutsedge earlier than what you ordinarily might. You know, with the years we've seen ryegrass come up real early because we had maybe some tropical systems come through in August, and we'll see some ryegrass flush up really early. I mean, there's always a response to it, and I think it's just in a constant state of change. And, I mean, you may have as good an explanation right there. Focusing on one thing, the other things get away from it, because, I mean, I've said that for years. Palmer drives the train. Every decision that we made has got to account for Palmer. I mean, it may not be the only thing we consider, but you've got to account for that in your game plan.
Right.
Any closing thoughts from y'all before we shut this down? First of all, it's fantastic to see you both in here.
I think it's just awareness of for the next generation, as Jason and Tom Allen and Eubank, as y'all are working with the new students and bringing them in and teaching them these concepts that we learned, not necessarily in class. We learned them from our professors and spending time out there. And honestly, us being together and talking about stuff, even though I was in industry and y'all were with universities, we still spent time together sharing knowledge. And I think that's critical for us going forward, that the next generations, as they come in and take our places, I'm the old guy here looking to cycle out before too long, hopefully, if my 401k does me right or I hit those magical six numbers. But that teamwork needs to continue in order for us to keep having the best product and process for the growers that we can do.
And I would just echo that, but it's important that we go back and revisit historically what's been done in the past and how these issues arose, because as the saying goes, that those that forget history are bound to repeat it. Educating this younger generation about these issues that we experienced in the past, and the weeds aren't going away. You know, we just got to learn to manage them with the tools that we have at hand, but we need to not forget historically too, the significance of the lessons learned, and that we don't go back and do those again.
That's sage advice from both of you. So thank you. We'd really appreciate the time this morning.
Guys, thank y'all. Frank, you had to drive. We appreciate it. And I know y'all's roles have changed multiple times over the years, but y'all are vitally important to weed science in Mississippi. I appreciate being able to pick up. Frank, I picked up the phone and called you last week about something. I talk to Tom often, so y'all are super, super important to our growers in the state, and I appreciate everything that y'all do.
It's fun and an honor.
Glad to be here.
The Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast is a production of Mississippi State University Extension.